From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, filmmaker Roger Nygaard. His latest movie aims to answer some of the toughest questions in the universe. Also, Sacramento's chef Tyler Stone and the Free Badge Serenaders, a duo that combines washboard banjo music and comedy. First, one of the few newspapers that charges readers online is the Stockton Record. The paper made the change in January, and we talked about it then with the paper's publisher. The context for this is a newspaper industry generally struggling to stay profitable and losing print readers. Many newspapers would like to charge online readers, but haven't figured out how or when to do it, or have already tried and given up. So, 6 months on, let's find out how being a subscription site is working for the Stockton Record. Roger Couver, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
How is it going to date? Is it going as well or less well as you expected?
It's actually going better than we anticipated. Just a quick review, you know, last February we set up to where anybody could see our local stories, national stories, anything, and up to 3 stories per month free. They could see 10 stories per month if they register, and if they want to see more than 10 local stories per month, they have to pay. Our results, we anticipated we could lose 50% of our viewership and unique users. We only lost about 25% of our unique users and about 30 to 35% of the total page views. We've received about 10,000 registered users who registered to receive 10 stories a month. And we've had about 66% of our subscribers paying the additional fee for them to continue to have full access. So we're very pleased with the early results. We certainly won't change. In fact, all the rest of the newspapers in our company are making plans and preparations to go the same direction.
So this is not an experiment?
No longer, no. I think it was when we first developed it, but this is permanent now.
Is it no longer an experiment because you decided that at the Stockton Record, or was that decision made higher up the corporate food chain?
Well, obviously higher up, they have the choice to do what they want, but certainly it was my recommendation to do this, and it's obviously beneficial to the company, so my recommendation to keep it, and that also goes along with Mr. Murdoch's decision that pretty much all the companies in our News Corp group will eventually go to pay sites.
Mr. Murdoch being Rupert Murdoch, of course.
Yes.
When you said that you thought you could lose maybe 50% of the unique viewers of your website, what was that based on? Was it based on other papers' experience of this, or was it just a guess?
It was looking at some of the early experiences people had and then a guess. And we wanted to guess high so that when we looked at financials to say, what's the downside of this, that we would go into it thinking conservatively.
Who's paying to view your stories, and who is saying to you, I'm not going to pay to see your stories?
Well, obviously, it's hard to determine. I will tell you, I was surprised. We do have 300 people who are paying for full online access without the print edition, and we actually charge more, you know, for our full online access if you don't get the print paper. So that surprised me a little, but there are certain people out of the area, obviously, who cannot get delivery, who want the access, but there's also local people who have said, I don't want to kill trees, or I don't want to have the paper in the driveway every morning, so I'm willing to pay for it online.
My guest is Roger Couver, publisher of the Stockton Record. The paper's website, recordnet.com, became a subscription site in January. At that time, it was an experiment. It's apparently gone well enough that it's no longer an experiment. And based on what Roger Couver says, it could spread throughout the rest of News Corp, the company, the huge company owned by Rupert Murdoch. There was another paper around the same time made the same decision, wasn't it?
Yes, I can tell you that the media news group that has the papers in the Bay Area, plus they have Chico. Chico is supposed to be going with our subscription site just any time now. Gannett has already put 3 of their papers up with pay sites to experiment, and I do know there are other papers in the country that, you know, the technology takes a long time to write the software and try to do it right. So it'll take a little longer for others to move in this direction, but virtually all newspapers, I believe, are looking at this.
Did you make any significant tweaks to the subscription site system after you rolled it out?
Not yet. We certainly have been looking at that. We're talking about design improvements, content changes, things to improve the service. You have to do that every day with the internet. But the focus so far has been to see what we could learn and then use that learning before we launch all of the other newspapers. And it'll probably be early next year before the company has time to get back around to, you know, our newspaper site and really start tweaking it again.
When we talked in January, you said that you'd received some complaints from people. I'm guessing you probably received others. What have people been saying to you? What are the main complaints, if there are any main complaints, and how do you deal with them?
There's actually very few, because we, on the print subscribers, they're not required to pay for that. So if they don't want internet access to local news, that's fine. And the real complaints come from people who mostly are on the internet, could be whether they're bloggers or just people who like surfing the internet a lot. They were used to getting everything for free, you know, and we certainly built that expectation by offering it free for years. And they just think we're crazy to think, well, I go somewhere else and I'll get my news. But the reality is local news, which is the only thing we're really protecting, we are the main source for that news.
Do you think the website will be able to pay for itself?
Well, it does today.
It does today?
Yes.
What have you learned from all this?
I guess the only thing is that, you know, reinforcing the original concept is that there is value in locally produced news. There is value in what our reporters and editors do in gathering, collecting, writing, editing the news content for people locally. If there is no value in that, obviously we don't have a business. And I guess the other piece is that the how people receive it, the distribution model, whether it's in paper or in digital, doesn't matter. It's the content that matters. And certainly the world is going more digital. We know with iPads and other hardware that will come out in years ahead that this is the direction that we will have to continue to go in.
And finally, Roger Coover, you must have talked about all this over the last few months with your colleagues, publishers, and editors at other papers in Northern California and elsewhere. You don't have to name names, but what have people said to you and asked you?
Well, I've actually made a presentation or two to other publishers at group meetings, trying to convince everybody that it's the right thing to do. I think it's a smart business decision for us, especially since, again, the world is moving more and more digital. Mostly they just ask me similar questions that you've asked. How is it going? What percentage of people are paying? Did I lose, you know, any print readers over this? And, you know, there has not been, you know, any real change in the print readership that I can correlate directly to this change to say, did we gain print readers? Did we lose any? There's just not enough. There's not been enough change to bring any correlation there. So I think more and more people are interested and will be as the technology becomes more readily available.
Roger Coover, publisher of the Stockton Record, the paper's website, recordnet.com, became a subscription site in January, charging for access to local news stories. Roger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, filmmaker Roger Nygaard. His latest movie aims to answer some of the toughest questions in the universe. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download Insight, find our archives at capradio.org/insight. Today on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, the intersection of politics and science, including the impact of the so-called ClimateGate emails, also fibers that can hear and transmit sound, and Apple's iPhone trouble. That's Science Friday after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Filmmaker Roger Nygaard is best known for his film Trekkies, about the eccentricities of some Star Trek fans. In his latest movie, he boldly goes to great thinkers around the world to get answers to tough questions like, why do we exist and is there an afterlife? The nature of existence shows in Sacramento this weekend. I asked Roger Nygaard how he managed to keep something that sounds impossibly ambitious focused.
I mean, you know, it's impossible. It can't be done. And so I think that's part of the challenge of the impossible is what drew me to the project partially. But, yeah, how do you choose? I mean, I really just started with the main question, which is the age-old existential question of why do we exist and what is our purpose here and how do we find happiness ultimately. Those questions led to many more questions. It's sort of like peeling this infinite existential onion. Every layer leads to another set of layers, and you keep trying to get closer and closer to that center, which you would call truth.
These questions, the questions you explore in the film, are the kinds of things people discuss in philosophy and theology seminars and well-meaning PBS hosts talk about at a table with other well-meaning people. How do you make a film out of it?
I think it's got to be funny and entertaining, and to me, life is absurd, and so we have to laugh or we'll go insane. And part of asking these questions is dealing with these big, serious questions. I mean, the biggest question of all is death. I mean, you know, it's the biggest, scariest thing we know, and so one way to deal with the things that we're afraid of is to laugh. Humor is how we cope. So I really tried to set out to find some interesting people who could entertain us while giving us some answers about where is the afterlife, define God, where was God during the Holocaust, why do we suffer? And in doing so, I collected a really interesting, at least to me, interesting group of people who not only give amazing insight into these things, they also make us laugh.
My guest is Roger Nygaard, the filmmaker. His latest is The Nature of Existence, and it shows the Sunday in Sacramento. There are 85 tough questions that are at the heart of the film. How did you come up with these questions?
Well, I started writing down a question or two or three, and pretty soon I had a long list. I started out interviewing my friends, or really interrogating my friends, mostly without their permission. And, you know, why are we here? What is the point? And those questions would lead to more questions. You know, once I asked people, why are we here, the most common answer, at least in a nation that's predominantly Christian, is to glorify God or to know God or to serve God. And then that begs the question, well, define for me, what do you mean by God? And what we find is that people tend to have different definitions. You know, when somebody asks me, well, do you believe in God? I have to first ask them, define your concept of God. I can't even answer until I know what you're asking me. You know, Gandhi once said that there are as many religions on the planet as there are people.
Did you reject any questions because you thought they were just too hard to answer or too controversial?
No, the harder the better. If they were hard, they made my list. Some of the questions, I guess, ultimately I rejected were the ones we've all heard before and sort of they've been answered to death. Like, you know, is a religion a good thing or is a religion a bad thing? I mean, we know about the Crusades and we know about charity work. You know, religion has its pluses and minuses. So that's not as interesting as a question like, you know, does an animal have a soul? Or if we pray and, like, we pray to stop a hurricane, but the hurricane comes anyway, what purpose does the prayer serve? You know, and I get lots of answers from people that they just like being heard. You know, if they feel like someone's listening, it makes them feel a lot better, even if the tragedy still comes. You know, free will. Do we really have a free will? Or is everything predetermined? And if God knows everything that's going to happen, then how can we truly have free will if he knows what choice we're going to make? Or that means he doesn't know everything in order for us to truly have free will, and, you know, et cetera. Should we have a person have sex before marriage? Is masturbation a sin? You know, the tougher the question, the more interesting the answers.
I was looking at the questions. They're listed on your website, thenatureofexistence.com, and some of the questions are very short, to the point, difficult to answer, but nevertheless short, like what is faith, what is truth? But some others seem a little bit more loaded, like under the category of scripture. How do we accept a holy book that positively portrays unacceptable behaviors like slavery, incest, murder, etc.? How do people handle that question?
Yeah, that's a great one. I mean, if you start reading the Old Testament from page 1, by page 15 or 20 or 30, you will have read about incest and revenge killings and murder and all kinds of slavery, how to beat your slaves. I mean, things that obviously we no longer feel is acceptable. So how do you, if you follow a particular holy book, incorporate or refuse to incorporate some things that are written in this text? And, you know, sometimes people call it cafeteria religion, where you take the little pieces you like and reject the others. But if you're choosing which pieces are okay and which aren't, then you're putting yourself above God, like saying you know better than God or you know better than whoever wrote this scripture. So it's a tough question, and how do people deal with it? I mean, maybe the toughest version of that question for me was, I asked Orthodox Jews, where was God during the Holocaust? Why would God allow 6 million of his chosen people to be not just murdered, but brutalized first, tortured, starved, you know, just horrendous treatment? And what the rabbi in the film says is that we have to look at each event and search for God within that event, meaning there is a purpose. There was a purpose to the Holocaust. So what could possibly have the purpose have been? Well, one answer is that the nation of Israel came about as a result of the Holocaust. It was one result. And it also, they tend to often see the looking for the message in the Holocaust, that God was sending a message, and the message was they were not being orthodox enough. And so, hence, they're getting back to more orthodoxy in order to appease the angry God.
Roger Nygaard, the filmmaker, his latest film is The Nature of Existence. It shows the Sunday in Sacramento. Many of the tough questions in the film are about things outside of us, the world, the universe, God, and so on. But some of them are about us. And one that really stood out for me was, why do people get angry when their beliefs are challenged? Why did that question interest you?
Yeah, well, I've had a lot of discussions with people, and when you ask questions, people started, you know, at least for me, they would start getting angry sometimes. And I wondered why that was. Some of the answers I got about that from psychologists were that if someone is working very hard to maintain a belief system that they themselves maybe don't fully embrace, they maybe have some doubts of their own, when you start asking questions, it shines a light on their own doubts, and it makes them frustrated that they have to work even harder to maintain this belief system. There's really two ways of looking at the universe. One is you look at all of the evidence and draw the best possible conclusion. And the other way is you have an answer provided to you, and then you ignore all the evidence that's contrary to that answer. Now, if you follow that particular paradigm, you've got to work very hard to weed out and keep that information away from you or your children or the people in your cult or group or religion or community or whatever. It's a lot of hard work, and so it can make you angry when people are, you know, maybe you feel like they're trying to inject information into your group that you prefer not to have, and hence the debate between evolutionists and creationists. It's really science, scientific view of the world, which takes all the evidence and makes the best possible conclusion, which continually changes as you get new evidence, or the more religious belief, which starts out with the answer and works backwards.
This is not the kind of film that's going to get 16 showings a day at the local multiplex, but yet it took you years to make, and you had to travel around the world. Wasn't it an expensive film to make?
That's one reason it took me so long, yeah. It took me 4 years of shooting and editing, after interviewing 170 people, each interview taking several hours each. One thing I often say before a screening is I warn people. I say, you probably should not see this movie because it's going to mess with your mind a little bit. You know, if your mind's already messy, you'll probably be okay. But if everything's stacked in little neat piles, they may get jostled a little bit. You know, your typical movie at the multiplex is diversion. It allows you to forget about your life. This film challenges people to think for themselves a little bit. And perhaps that will, you know, shake some people up. For me, and a lot of people who have, after the film, you know, felt really stimulated by it, like the idea of challenging themselves, learning more. I mean, because once you stop learning and stop challenging yourself, you've begun dying. Once you stagnate, you're on your way down. You're on your way out. The idea of retiring makes no real sense for a human being. I mean, I understand if you're working a job you hate and you don't want to do that anymore, but Confucius said if you pick a job doing something you love doing, you'll never work a day in your life. Then it makes no sense to retire. And so the film gives you concepts and ideas like that that are really positive and motivational, and often I feel like audiences are really left in a much more positive space after having seen the movie.
You're probably best known for the films Trekkies and Trekkies 2, and I'm just wondering how Star Trek fans treat you because of those films, because your films were good-natured, but at the same time, Star Trek fans, especially the ones who dress up like Spock and so on, sometimes get a little defensive about being poked, having fun poked at them. How do people react? How do Star Trek fans think about your films?
I like to think we're poking fun with them, but there was a minority of people who were very unhappy with the first Trekkies film, and the number one criticism was, why didn't you show more normal Star Trek fans? And I don't know what normal means. I mean, who am I to decide what's normal? All I know is what's interesting to me, anyway. Who are the more exceptional people? You know, I wouldn't use the word, who are the weirdest. I'd say who's the most exceptional. If you make a documentary about, I don't know, baseball players, you're not going to put the guys that bat 200. You're going to put the guys that bat 400, the exceptional players. They're more interesting. And so it was the same with Trekkies. When that question, that criticism came up, I revisited it in Trekkies 2, and I said, okay, let me put it to the fans. Define for me what is a normal Star Trek fan. And when I asked them, of course, there was no agreement. Everybody had their own definition, usually which was based on themselves. The amount of fandom or expression of their love for this TV show that they showed, that was normal. And people who went beyond what they chose were abnormal. And we tend to judge other people's beliefs and expressions and religious expressions by what we feel is normal for us. But who are we to say? Who am I to say? All I know is if these people are entertaining and interesting or have something insightful or dynamic to say, you're going to see them in my movie.
Finally, Roger Nygaard, another thing you've done in your career is you directed an episode of the TV show The Office, and I was just curious to know how much of that show is scripted and how much is improvised?
Well, The Office is fully scripted with a little bit of improv when there's time on the set, in a little bonus improv, but that's a very tightly, heavily scripted show. I also work on a show editing called Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yes. Which is the other side of the pole, which is very loosely scripted and heavily improvised. So you get different results, and equally funny, I think, but they're just different ways to approach it.
And yet both have a feeling of being improvised. Is that something you have to do as a director to make sure that the scripted show, The Office, still has that loose feeling of improvisation?
Yeah, well, the style of the film came from Survivor. The camera operators on the show were working on Survivor, and they came and brought the exact same style that they used on Survivor, where they're looking for those real moments. So they'll be zooming in and zooming out and finding, with the office, they're sort of pretending to find those moments. But they really are finding those moments because there's no shot list in the usual sense. You leave it up to the camera operators to find the shots and the angles, and you spend more time working on the setup and the actors and the rest of the elements, aside from having to decide master shot, close-up, single.
How interesting. Well, thank you so much. Roger Nygaard, filmmaker. His latest movie is The Nature of Existence. It aims to try and answer 85 tough questions like, why do we exist? It shows this Sunday at the Guild Theatre in Sacramento. It's part of the Movies on a Big Screen series, and it starts at 7:30. Roger, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, and I'd love to hear what all your listeners think about these questions. If you go to our website, you too can answer the questions and post your answers on our website, thenatureofexistence.com. And the movie's opening in theaters around the country over the summer. And, of course, you'll see us on home video later in the fall.
Okay. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Chef Tyler Stone, a 21-year-old from Sacramento who's prepared food for some well-known people. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison at capradio.org/insight. You'll find more about our topics and guests. Speaking of which, next week, our guests and topics include UC Berkeley law professor John Yoo, who's best known as a Justice Department lawyer who wrote the legal opinion supporting the use of so-called enhanced interrogation procedures with suspected terrorists. And Noble Heights, a new film about a man with cerebral palsy who hiked to the top of Clouds Rest, an 11,000-foot summit in Yosemite. Sacramento's chef Tyler Stone is only 22, not 21 as I said earlier, but he's already cooked for some well-known people and has his own recipe book. He's also doing cooking shows at this year's California State Fair. He's in our studio. Chef Tyler Stone, welcome to Insight.
Thanks a lot, Jeffrey. It's my pleasure to be here.
How old were you when you first cooked something?
Actually, you know, when I was 4 years old is when I really started to cook. And that was a funny story. I got a toy for Christmas, and it made out little French fry strips with a piece of plain crustless white bread. And that's my first time cooking for my dad.
Was it a coincidence that the toy you were given made food?
No, not really. I mean, I've always been very good with my hands, and I've always been very creative. So I think I was just naturally kind of gifted towards doing something with my hands, and food just came naturally because, you know, unlike most things, you got to eat your mistakes, you know.
And I'm guessing your mom probably encouraged you in this.
You know, actually, I was the real driving force. I had told my folks I had gone to a local culinary academy at age 11, and I was really the driving force behind that. They thought it was just kind of a phase I was going through, but I really kind of forced them into taking me and doing it because that's what I wanted to do. So,
my guest is Chef Tyler Stone. Why did you think at such a young age that it would be good to go to a culinary academy?
Well, you know, I mean, I wanted to learn more about cooking. I wasn't a great chef. You know, I still have a lot to learn, obviously. I'm a young man myself, but at that time, I didn't know as much about cooking. So that was my natural instinct, was to learn more about it, and what better place than a culinary academy.
What did the academy make of someone so young saying, I want to be a student here?
Well, it was actually pretty novel. I was the youngest student, and all the people in the class were a lot older. They were adults, obviously, but they thought it was very cool that someone my age, you know, kind of had the gusto to go and take charge and get in there and get your hands dirty, so to speak. So,
well, you told us about your first experience of making food. Did you just start making food regularly at home?
Oh, well, that became the everyday meals. I would be preparing breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So, you know,
really?
Mom and dad never cooked much after that.
What kind of food were you making for the family when you were, I don't know, six?
Well, you know, I would probably be doing things like pastas and, you know, omelets, things like that, cooking scrambled eggs. Very simple stuff, but, you know, kind of perfecting the very basics and then, you know, working on that and then obviously expanding upon that.
When did you go from thinking, well, this is a fun thing to do, to, you know, this might be what I want to do as my job?
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, you had mentioned earlier on one of your segments, one of the quotes was, you know, if you do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And so for me, cooking is really how do I express myself the best way possible? And for me, that is cooking, because A, you can be creative, and B, you're also fulfilling a need, which is to feed yourself. You know, that's probably, you know, one of the top three things of, you know, mankind, you know, eat, sleep, and work. So, I mean, you got to eat. And so I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone by doing that.
So when you went to the Culinary Academy as a boy, it was with a view to learning how to be a professional chef.
Definitely, definitely. I wanted definitely to become a professional chef. That's what I was really interested in doing. Because A, I could express myself in many creative ways. You know, food is always evolving. And, you know, nowadays there's trends out there like molecular cooking, things like that, bringing science into the kitchen. So, you know, chefs are no longer just, you know, relegated to the kitchen. They're authors. Like, you know, I have my own book that I published when I graduated high school at age 18. You know, they're writers. I write for two magazines. One's House to Home Showcase, and one is Welcome Home. That's in 14 markets around the nation. But they're also scientists now. You know, they're looking at how do we develop new techniques and bring a lot of make cooking fun. You know, and exciting, which is very cool. And I like to get people excited about food and cooking.
A lot of kids when they're growing up, not only are not very interested in making food, they're not very interested in many kinds of food. It's like cans of alphabet spaghetti and stuff like that. Did you have adventurous tastes when you were young?
You know, I did have adventurous. I had finer tastes. You know, I had, you know, if it called for French camembert, I had to use it. You know, so I always was very interested in exploring new tastes and textures. And you know, that's one of the problems with, you know, kids these days. And that's what I'm doing at the State Fair a lot is teaching people and especially kids how to cook and how to cook things that they're going to want to eat. You know, most kids don't want to try things because, you know, they're afraid it might not taste good or, you know, and usually, you know, if you've ever, you know, growing up, you know, you've had something that your mom or dad's cooked and it's been some green beans or something. And you're like, oh, mushy green beans. And they're all gray, you know. So that's what I try to show people, proper ways to do things, better ways to do things. So that way they can get excited about it. And then they'll at least try it. And now knowing that it's something much better than what they've had before, they're going to want to continue to eat that.
Was food an important part of your upbringing? Did anyone in your family work in the food business or anything like that?
That's a very good question. You know, everyone asks, you know, you went to local culinary academy and, you know, your parents must have been professional chefs. And the answer is no, none of my family on both my sides of my family, my mom or my dad, has ever been in the business professionally. You know, my mom's probably the greatest thing I could attribute to, you know, me being in the culinary field is my mom's side. My grandfather, who was from Germany originally, emigrated here during the World War. And he always started his own garden, organic. You know, they had 2 acres of land and did all their own butchery and had a chicken coop. So maybe that's where I get, you know, my culinary instinct from. But no one's ever been in the business, so to speak, for, you know, to make money or to be a professional chef.
My guest is Tyler Stone, a chef from Sacramento. He's doing cooking demonstrations at this year's California State Fair and also offering his book, his first cookbook, The Kids Cooking, which came out when he was 18. He's now 22. You've cooked for some very well-known people, including the Maloofs. How did that come about?
You know,
the Maloofs who won the Sacramento Kings.
That's correct. You know, as it turns out, a lot of things in showbiz or in, you know, when you're cooking for these kinds of high-caliber people, you know, it helps to know people. So luckily, I have a friend of the family who knew them in business and had hooked me up with their head chef who cooks for the family personally. And through that, I was able to cook for them multiple times at both Arco Arena and at their home, which was very cool. Very nice guys and, you know, very simple taste. You know, they're not too fussy about what they like. They like a nice steak and, you know, very simple fare, which is good for me because it makes things less complicated. But that was a lot of fun. But, yeah, I've cooked for quite a few people and
yeah,
I've always enjoyed it.
Well, in addition to the Maloofs and John Tesh and the Doobie Brothers, you also have prepared dinner for Vice President and Mrs. Cheney. How did that happen?
Well, that was another interesting story. You know, it does help to know people, especially in that instance. You know, even with knowing a friend of the former vice president, it still took me almost probably a little over 2 years to be able to have the opportunity. And, you know, regardless of political affiliation, it was such a great honor because, you know, it's the vice president and the only step up from there is the president. But luckily, I got a tour of the White House after I did that. So that was pretty fun, too.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you mentioned the column that you write for House to Home magazine. And in the latest one, the article's called Art of the Garnish. And you wrote, you eat with your eyes first and then the tongue. This means most diners decide how much they will like something before they've even lifted their fork. Is that a challenge you embrace or is that an unfortunate aspect of cooking that what it tastes like comes after the visual aspect?
Well, you know, I think it's just natural. It's human nature. It's that preconceived notion of, you know, how you think something will be based upon its appearance before you even taste it or, you know, it could be, you know, from hearing it, you know, you never know. So that's really, you know, if you look at the best chefs in the world, the best restaurants, all the presentations are always top-notch because, A, it's what their guests come to expect, but, B, I think it also adds to the whole total package, the experience. You know, I could make the best meal in the world with the finest ingredients, and if I just throw it all on a plate without taking some time to present it nicely, your idea of that dish is not going to be nearly as lofty or as grand as if I had made some fancy garnish and taken my time and really presented it in the best way possible. So you do eat with your eyes first. If it looks great, you're going to have a better idea of, you know, how it's going to taste, and you're going to have a better experience.
Since you're a professional chef, how do you feel about cooking when you get home and it's maybe late in the evening and you're hungry? Do you actually make something from scratch yourself?
Well, you know, that's funny because, you know, even the greatest chefs in the world, you look at like the Thomas Kellers or the Charlie Trotters, you know, you ask them what they like to eat after working a whole night shift, and more times than not, they'll tell you a hamburger, an In-N-Out, or, a chicken sandwich or something like that, roast chicken. You know, when you're cooking high caliber food and upscale cuisine for all your clients, that's the last thing you want to eat. But, you know, really with me, I'm very health conscious as well. You know, I was the spokesman for the American Heart and also for other charitable organizations that deal with health. And I've developed lots of healthy recipes and demonstrated them on television since I was about 12. So I've always been health-minded, health-conscious. And for me, I work out a lot. I try to take care of my body. So when I get home, I want to eat something that's delicious but also healthy. And that's not too complicated because, you know, at the end of the day, the last thing you want to do is be on your feet for any extended period of time. You want to get your food and get done and go to bed, you know.
Yeah.
Get some rest.
Tyler Stone, chef from Sacramento. He's 22. His first cookbook, The Kids Cooking, came out when he was 18. He's doing cooking demos at this year's California State Fair, along with signing copies of his book. Your next show at the State Fair is Saturday at 5.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're doing others throughout the run of the fair.
Definitely.
Great. Tyler Stone, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Free Badge Serenaders. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something? Tell us what and why at insight@capradio.org. Today on Capital Public Radio News, today and tomorrow have been declared the first Spare the Air Days of the year in Sacramento. That story and more on All Things Considered. The Free Badge Serenaders, a washboard and banjo duo that combines comedy and old-time music, just released their first record. It's called Discount Jazz. There's a release party tonight at Sacramento's Comedy Spot. They're in our studio with their sundry instruments. They are Greg Sabin and Patrick Skiffington. Guys, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us. We're glad to be here.
Now, Greg, we've talked with you before on Insight and your other incarnation as a food writer.
Yes.
Or
yes,
one of your other incarnations as a food writer.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, how did you and Patrick get the idea for a band that would do comedy and old-time jazz?
I think it was the jazz idea first, and then the comedy comes when we make lots of mistakes for the most part. And you have to fill a lot of time when you have a banjo and a washboard. There's not really a lot of musicality you can impress people with after about the first song.
Yeah, but Patrick, there's also a kind of humorous element to a lot of that old-time jug jazz music.
Of course. And like Greg said, a lot of ours is unintended. So it comes off that much more, shall we say, fresh.
Yes, but it's not just random that you guys decided to play this kind of music because, in fact, you both learned this kind of stuff when you were young, didn't you, Greg?
Yeah. As teenagers, we were playing in bands sponsored by the Sacramento Traditional Jazz Society.
As in Jazz Jubilee fame?
Yes, the Jazz Jubilee organization. And, we took a break from the music for a while.
Yeah, we took a short hiatus. We did a lot of work as mercenaries in Eastern Europe. And where the washboard is considered a tool of Yankee imperialism. So I didn't get to play a lot of jazz over there, but we've come back, and hopefully someday we'll make a return to the actual festival, the Sacramento Jubilee.
I've got to say, Patrick, for people who can't see you, you have a lot more tattoos on your body than the average musician at the Sacramento Jubilee.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Usually on stage we have to wear suits and, that kind of thing, vests and hats. And, today I'm casual, my regular pink tutu and halter top. I really enjoy the liberties that this medium affords.
Yes. That's Patrick Skiffington. He sings and plays washboard and various other instruments in the Free Badge Serenaders. The other member of the duo is Greg Sabin. He sings and plays banjo and various other instruments and writes some of the band's songs. And you're going to play what would be, I would have to say, your biggest hit record.
Oh, our biggest hit.
So far.
This has
so
at far. Least been played on the internet radio once.
Yes.
So I think that's totally a hit at that point.
Well, it's going to get played again. So
all right.
Tell us what it
right
is.
Now, this is a song about our fair city, our hometown of Sacramento, California, USA. Knew a girl named Gina from Pasadena, said she was from L.A. Or Alejandro from San Leandro, said he lived on the bay. But I don't have to fib about where I live, cause I'm from Sacramento, California, USA. Or
Or how about Pierre? Thought he was debonair, said he was from Paris. Or beautiful Raquel, thought she was swell, said she was from Napoli. But Raquel was from New Rochelle, and Pierre from Marseille. But I'm from Sacramento, California, USA. Don't you know it's so close to the coast, you can almost smell the sea. In fact, you're always just 2 hours from where you'd rather be. So if you want to go to Lake Tahoe or Carmel by the sea, why don't you stop and set up shop in a town with proximity? Why don't you come and stay in the city near the city by the bay? Sacramento, California, USA. Play that slide whistle. City might seem. Odds are your mayor can't dunk on Hakeem, cause the weather is lousy in Boise, and I hear that Austin is mighty noisy. I love Sacramento, California, USA. You know, Bismarck and Pierre are mighty square, and for that matter, so is Cheyenne. And you know, Carson City really ain't so pretty unless you like hot air and dry sand. Because Springfield is too anonymous, and Oklahoma City too eponymous. I love Sacramento, California, USA. Don't you know that it's so close to the coast, you can almost smell the sea. In fact, you're always only 2 hours from where you'd rather be. So if you want to go to Lake Tahoe or Carmel by the sea, why don't you stop and set up shop in a town with proximity? Why don't you come and stay in the city near the city by the bay? Sacramento, California, USA. Oh, it's not your fault if you're from Galt. So I'll let you say you're from Sacramento, California, USA.
Sacramento, California, USA, performed in our studio by our guests, the Freebad Serenaders. Greg, you wrote that song. Why the gratuitous Galt reference?
Oh, well, A, it rhymed with fault. So usually any town, a single-syllable town, is I think, rife for humor.
Yes. Great game.
Really, I can't think of any other. Lock, nobody knows lock or ride. And yeah. I like
Visalia
the people
is too hard to
yeah.
Lodi, what would you rhyme with that?
Yeah. We tried to say don't go to Modesto or you will get Molesto, but that didn't
yeah, it didn't
did
really
not work.
Fit. Yeah.
You guys live in Sacramento. You play this old jug jazz. How come you weren't playing at the Jazz Jubilee or Jazz Festival?
I
think that's a question for the Sacramento Traditional Jazz Society. Our listeners at home, if you get on your phone and give them a ring, they're located in West Sac. Go ahead and Google Sacramento Traditional Jazz Society. Give them a ring right now. I believe their office hours are current.
And we didn't get an application.
Tell them the Free Badge Serenaders.
And what is the Free Badge thing about?
Well, speaking of the Jazz Festival, it's always been our dream to go there for free because we both of us have attended since we were very wee lads. And, it's a sizable amount of money. And for myself, who is recently, as of very recently, making minimum wage, we'll see later today, we'd like to get in for free. And the way people don't have tickets there, they have badges or buttons. And so we'd like to get our badges for free. Cool. Which means so that we can go to all these jazz festivals that we go to, we would love to play them.
Great. My guests are the Freebad Serenaders. Their new record is called Discount Jazz. They have a concert tonight in Sacramento. It starts at 8 at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. Greg, you got another song to do?
Yes, in fact. Now, we have a little surprise for you, Jeffrey.
Okay.
We wrote a special song just for our appearance on Insight.
Oh, well, that was not obligatory, but
no. Well, hey, you provided us the forum,
right.
And we're going to
we
pay
go the extra mile for comedy
in song.
The extra mile, excellent. Well, let's hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Scottish lilt with its every little tilt and its every bend from every loch and glen. Oh, you know it when you hear it, and you'd be right to fear it, the coming of the Scotsman. For a Scotsman in California gets to have his haggis and eat it too. Oh, the ladies swoon whenever he croons. The fellas think he's tough. If that weren't enough, he gets to eat avocados every day. A Scotsman in California.
I'm quite honored. That was great. I'm sure it took a long time to create that.
Yeah, we learned a lot about Scotland this past weekend. That's
yes,
for
you
sure.
Did.
It's amazing what you can find on the Wikipedia.
Yeah, you know, I wish I could have my haggis and eat it, though. It's kind of hard to find around these parts.
They don't have canned haggis in the local store?
We were going to bring a preserved sheep stomach for you, but it went bad in the car.
Isn't that the skin of the banjo?
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
That's Patrick Skiffington and Greg Sabin. They are the Free Badge Serenaders. They play washboard, banjo, and sundry other instruments. Their new record is called Discount Jazz. It's got lots of great songs on it, including one called The Mortgage Song. It's very timely, very topical. And there's a release party tonight in Sacramento at the Sacramento Comedy Spot. Not surprising, they do comedy, they do jug jazz, and it's pretty awesome stuff. Greg Sabin, Patrick Skiffington, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight's theme was written by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Natalie Rothfels, Mara Ponce, and Sosin Morar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.
Back in 05, I felt so alive when we bought our first home. A lovely 3-2 made for me and you, with a reverse amortization interest-only loan. But now that you say you found someone new, and there's no more you and me, oh, my poor heart is bursting with negative equity. I'm upside down in love, girl, and on my mortgage too. My heart is broken, so am I, since I don't have you. I need that second income to pay my bills. They've frozen all my assets, and that gives me the chills. Oh, when are you coming back? The signals you send are mixed. Why do you fluctuate your love and rate? Why can't you keep it fixed? I'm upside down in love, girl, and on my mortgage too. My heart is broken, so
lawmakers have declared this California Youth Crisis Line Awareness Month. On the next Insight, what is the Youth Crisis Line and who does it help? Plus, on Insight's 6th anniversary, we follow up on a variety of topics we've covered in the last year, including recent discussions on pesticide use on strawberries and the imminent closing of the Chief Crazy Horse Saloon. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
Monday morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.